Happy Monday, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the HD View. This is Melissa Biliardi, your host, and tonight our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. When you call in, press 1. We'll cue you into the show, and please tell all your colleagues, friends, and family about Help for HD Radio. Click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. Thank you, 54,934 listeners, for tuning in this Monday. Our incredible special guest is the esteemed Dr. Mary Edmondson from Duke University, North Carolina. She is a physician, psychiatrist, and a founder of the North Carolina Center for the Care of Huntington's Disease. That's nccchd.org. Last week, we learned about anosognosia, which is the medical term for lack of awareness, from Dr. LaVon Goodman. And tonight, Dr. Edmondson will expand on that knowledge by talking about strategies to communicate with people who are experiencing this condition, anosognosia, and how to keep them engaged with family and medical care. Dr. Edmondson has a professional and personal understanding of Huntington's disease, so she knows the struggles and fears within the Huntington's community. She's here to help us tonight, and we are so grateful for her time with us. Please get your questions ready and send them to us in the chat room or call into the show. Again, call in numbers 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. Now, tonight, nothing that Dr. Edmondson is going to say is evidence-based, so little in HD is, but based on her experience and to some extent experience, she wants to avoid talking about medication management. So tonight we introduce again to our show. We are happy to have her back, Dr. Mary Edmondson. How are you tonight?
I'm great, Melissa. Thank you so much for inviting me tonight.
Welcome back.
it's my pleasure. what I wanted to do was talk about anosognosia, because I know that Dr. Goodman helped everyone understand it last week. But I think it's a really key symptom, because if someone's unaware of a problem that they have, they aren't going to be willing to address it. And there are many significant problems that occur at different times in the stage of disease with Huntington's, and that require some form of intervention, and some that are extremely helpful. But they're not helpful unless someone's willing to do them. They're not willing to take a medication, or they're not willing to go to the doctor, or they're not even willing to entertain a diagnosis. And so I hear from people all the time, what do I do if I can't get him to the doctor? What do I do if I can't get her to understand that screaming at me is just not acceptable? So, mm-hmm. And the number of psychiatric symptoms associated with Huntington's, like irritability and perseveration and depression and anxiety, and, you know, the myriad of psychiatric components of Huntington's, you can't get to those if someone's not willing to work with you. So, let me back up just a bit and make sure that I have got my terms correct with you guys, so that you know what I'm talking about. So there's four different ways of looking at awareness, and some of them are healthy and some of them are not. So self-deception is something that we all do. There are things that we would like to believe about ourselves that aren't completely true. We have a script in our head about who we are and about what we do and about how others perceive us, or we want others to perceive us. And so some of the things that we tell ourselves are not entirely true. Like, oh, I don't need to worry about eating that brownie tonight, or I can drink one more beer and drive. You know, so there's these little white lies that we tell ourselves.
Regardless of whether you have Huntington's.
Regardless of whether you have Huntington's or not.
Yep.
So that's one definition. The second definition is denial. And denial is, it's a defense mechanism that is a way of keeping out of our conscious mind emotionally unacceptable thoughts or unacceptable realities. And by definition, there's a reason for it. It is on some level functional for the person who denies the reality. And it is because if they accept that into their conscious mind, it's going to be overwhelming. It's
right.
They're not going to be able to function. So denial, although you might see something as being completely obvious and another person is having difficulty accepting that and dealing with it, it doesn't mean that that individual is weak. It means they're in the process of garnering their personal resources to come to terms with a reality that's too difficult for them. And at that moment that happens, people develop insight into what their reality is. So insight is the capability of understanding the significance of what's going on around us, the significance of our thoughts and our emotions and our behavior. And insight, you know, understanding yourself and others, is we give a great deal of credence to insight, but insight is like the last thing that happens in a process of understanding a new reality.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things, self-deception, denial, and insight, are things that we all do all the time. That has nothing to do with Huntington's and everything to do with Huntington's.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a process of thinking that we all go through. And people with Huntington's do that. People that care for people who have Huntington's go through that. And the rest of the world goes through that. Anagnosia, or unawareness, is something entirely different. So if there are lesions in specific parts of the brain, for example, if somebody has a stroke in a particular part of the brain, they may not have any strength or sensation in that part of their brain, but they are unaware that they can't move their left arm. They're totally unaware that their arm is not working.
Even with stroke victims, right?
With stroke victims or people that have frontal lobe tumors or parietal lobe tumors, brain cancer basically,
mm-hmm.
they may have a complete lack of understanding. It's not a lack of understanding. It's truly a lack of awareness.
Right.
And in the course of illness, many people with Huntington's develop anagnosia. So this is very raw data that I'm going to tell you about, and it needs to be refined more.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we understand about the time course of unawareness in Huntington's. So in the PREDICT data, and the PREDICT study was a group of 500-plus people who were gene-positive and enrolled in the study for the purposes of following aspects of their disease over time. So, you know, when they were not sick, to the time that they're diagnosed. And what they found is that when people were getting close to diagnosis, that is motor diagnosis, that the caregiver's report of symptom severity began to differ from the patient's report of symptom severity. So up until about, you know, right before motor diagnosis, there's a similar appreciation for symptom severity. But after that, it gets worse on the part of caregivers, but it plateaued for patients. And it wasn't a function of caregiver distress, you know, oh my gosh, they're sick, I feel so bad, and, you know, it's sort of a combined distress. It wasn't that at all, because the independent raters also noted this increase in symptoms.
Hmm.
So there's a point in time when people with HD are fully aware, and then there's a point where they become less and less aware of what's going on around them. Now, like I said, that's very raw data, and I wouldn't say, oh, you were just had a motor diagnosis of Huntington's, therefore you're unaware. It's not that perfect. There's a lot of scatter in the data, but the point about it is that this is not just something we're observing. It's something that can be measured. Okay? And it's been measured in several diseases.
Yeah.
In psychiatric illnesses, we call that a lack of insight, but it's the same biological basis for schizophrenia and bipolar disorder that there is in Huntington's. That is, that we just call it differently because one's a neurologic disease and one's a psychiatric disease, but it's the same thing. So the question is, how do you sort out in someone who has Huntington's whether or not they're deceiving themselves, whether they're denying what's happening, or whether they're fully unaware?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a million-dollar question. Jane Paulson actually made a very, really wonderful observation, and that is that HD patients may do all of those things. They may be denying what they do see and unaware of what's there.
Mm-hmm.
And that maybe on some level, being unaware is adaptive. It actually functions such that people continue to try and that they actually work to remain in control of what they can do and focus less on what they can't. So at any one point in time, although you would really, you know, most of us try really hard to put ourselves in the place of another person. We try to empathize with where they're at. And I don't think people that don't have Huntington's understand what it feels like to have Huntington's because, by definition, we don't have a part of our brain that's perceiving and thinking and understanding the world. We have a part of our brain that functions, and we're not even aware of it. We're not aware of it either.
Mm-hmm.
We're not aware of what we can do automatically, just like Huntington's patients are unaware of what they are beginning to be unable to do unconsciously. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it could be different from one day to the next.
Absolutely.
So it's
absolutely.
It's not a static situation, I don't think, from what I've seen, just in my own very little experience that I've had with it.
I guess that's theoretically possible that you could have cells that are sick that don't function particularly well one day and function better the next.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, anagnosia is kind of a fixed defect.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you another example. If you walk across the room, right, you're saying to yourself, I want to go there, and you just go. And your brain coordinates all your muscles so that some of them contract and some of them relax. And you're not thinking about that as you walk across the room because all you're trying to do is get to the lamp to cut it on. If you had to think about every little tiny thing that was involved in walking over there to cut the light on, you'd never get anything done. So your brain has this ability to shut off those things and do it for you. So you are unaware of all the things that go into walking across the room. That's the best example that I can give you of unawareness is that some people with Huntington's have no awareness that they have chorea until they look in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because it's an unconscious part of their brain anyway, right?
Right.
So, and many of the things that are affected in Huntington's are under your consciousness. They are things that you do automatically that you don't realize that you do. You just don't realize it. And so I think it's very difficult for us to put ourselves in the shoes of somebody with Huntington's. So even though we can't, I'm not implying that we don't still need to strive to do so. We need to strive to do so all the time, and we need to strive all the time to say, what is this like for you, you know, as opposed to thinking that we know. In any case, that doesn't solve the problem at hand, does it?
No.
It does not solve the problem at hand to understand it and to understand why it's happening, or even to call it denial, or to call it insight, or to call it anything. It doesn't help you deal with it. So these are the few tips that I can give you that I think help. The first thing is that I think it's extremely important to define the problem that you're having. So if the problem is that you're having is that your loved one gets agitated and irritable and is in distress and they have behavior that's kind of threatening to you and other people. So it's, you would look at that behavior and you would, you know, even separate from yourself, you would say, wow, that must be terrible to live through, to have these episodes. And if that is the problem, that you want to relieve that individual of the suffering of that, or you want to relieve the people who live around that person of the suffering of that behavior, then that is the goal, is to figure out how to relieve that. The goal is not to get somebody to understand they have Huntington's disease. The goal is to get them to understand that the problem that they have, this moment that's so uncomfortable for them and for everyone around them, is something that we need to address. And the way to talk to somebody about that behavior is the same way that you would talk to anybody about a behavior that you see as a problem between you and another person. So define the problem and be extremely specific. And if you can't define the problem to yourself, you are never going to be able to define it to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't put words, you can't put like our typical irritability, perseveration, you can't put those words to it, because it's an experience that you can say, well, you remember last Tuesday when we were going wherever, or last Tuesday when I said it was time for a bath, or whatever, whatever example that you can provide that individual can go back and say, oh, that's what you're talking about, and this was my experience of it. So anyway, that's what I'm saying, is you have to be able to define it, and it's going to be really helpful if you have an example of it. So the first step one is define it and know what it is you're asking for.
How does obsessive compulsive behaviors enter into that?
Well, obsessive compulsive behaviors can be very distressing for the person who experiences them. They are in some ways more difficult for caregivers than they are for the person who experiences them. So, because it takes work to redirect somebody who's perseverating.
Yeah.
And that actually, that is the period of greatest work for a caregiver, is when somebody is perseverative.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's the problem. Maybe the problem is I'm the one who's suffering, and I'm the one that needs help dealing with this, because I am going nuts. I can't get anything done. I can't make any progress. I can't go to the grocery store. I can't do anything.
Right.
And that would be really, that's an understandable problem. And it's an okay problem to have. But you have to define it, because you've got to decide whether it's yours or whether it's theirs.
How do you go about defining that? What are some of the maybe tricks or tips that you might have to actually define the problem at hand?
I think journaling is a really great way of doing it. So getting it out there some way, if you don't have someone that you can talk to and say, this is what happened, help me figure this out, if you don't have anybody that you can email with, you don't have anybody that you can talk to, you don't have a therapist, whatever it is, then you have to talk to yourself, and you sit down and you journal it. And you write it all down. You don't censor yourself. You don't get mad at yourself about whatever you feel or think. You write it down just exactly the way it happened and exactly the way you feel about it. And then back off and look at it again, and the problem will surface.
Mm-hmm.
You will be able to understand.
Maybe through patterns or something.
No, it's actually more like looking at it and saying, that's where the emotion is.
Oh.
Is the emotion in me, or is the emotion in the other person? Is the suffering within me, or is the suffering within the other person? And once it becomes the suffering, you can figure out where it's at, then you can start defining, these are the specific problems.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that's very hard for caregivers, because they're working very, very hard.
Mm-hmm.
And carving out a half an hour to do that at the end of a very exhausting day can be a really difficult thing to do. But the truth of the matter is, people that journal a half an hour every day feel better than people that don't.
Mm-hmm.
Proven. It's proven. So that's the probably the best technique I can think of to help yourself figure out exactly what the problem is.
Right, because you're writing your feelings down. You're addressing your own feelings about the actual problem at hand, which can give you a little better insight in your own dealings with
right.
it.
Right. Plus you're making observations about what's going on with the other person.
Mm-hmm.
You're making observations about them, and you're making observations about yourself. And you're kind of validating the experience. You're not judging it. You're not judging
mm-hmm.
the other person, and you're not judging yourself. It is what it is. So you write all that stuff down, and the problem becomes clear to you. And if the problem is within yourself, then you know what you have to work on. You have to work on yourself.
Right.
And maybe it's your own denial. Maybe it's your own self-deception, whatever it might be. Maybe you just need some help, which is, you know, a lot of people just, they just need some help and relief.
Right.
And that is a hard thing for some people to ask for.
Mm-hmm.
But if the problem lies within the other person, particularly the person with HD, how do you ask that person to change? Isn't that the core of it? I need to ask you to change. So if I'm going to ask you to change your behavior, under what circumstances am I most likely to get the best result? And what is the way that I can be most effective in asking you to change? So these are some tips that I'll give you. And you can, I'm going to tell you that there's a book that I told Melissa about called The Dialectical Behavioral Skills Workbook that has, I'll talk about that some more, but the techniques that I'm talking about are a group of those skills called interpersonal effectiveness skills. And that workbook will give you lots of examples about what I'm talking about doing. In any case, if there's something that you want someone else to do, you need to do a couple things. You need to describe very calmly what it is that's the trouble, what it is that's the issue. And remember that people with Huntington's have difficulty with attention. So what I tend to do is I tend to get close to somebody's face. You can't do this when somebody's agitated. They have to be pretty calm.
Wait till they calm down.
Oh, yeah. This has to be when that person is at their best place. So if their best moment is in the morning after they've eaten breakfast and their shower is over with and they're happy, that would be the time to do this. You don't do this when someone's upset, okay? But in any case, what I do is I try and fill up their visual field so there are no distractions, and that's why I get close to people's face. You describe what it is that's the issue. You express yourself, and you express why you would like that individual to do something differently. And then you explain what would be the positive consequences if they did that. There would be a number of good things that would happen if you would work with me to change this one thing. You have to feel centered and good and confident about what you're asking for. That helps a lot. And then you have to be willing to negotiate. You have to be willing to say, okay, you don't want to go to the doctor now. Maybe we could do it in a week. And by the way, we're going to really stick to a week. And next week, we're not going to negotiate this. Okay, next week we will not.
Mm-hmm.
Time is up. The clock is dead. The timer is off. So, and when you do this, when you're reinforcing this, you may get pushback. And if you get pushback, you let somebody calm down, and then you use a technique called broken record. You just say it again.
Mm-hmm.
You say, this is what I would really like for you to do. And if they get upset, you let them calm down and you say, this is what I would like for you to do.
Mm-hmm.
And sooner or later, somebody's going to realize you're not going to give up, and they're going to listen, and they'll turn their mind more toward negotiation, or they'll completely shut off,
mm-hmm.
and you'll have to wait for a different time.
Another day.
And another day. And
yeah. mm-hmm.
so this really only works when the person that you're talking to, believes you care about them.
Mm, yeah.
So if you haven't done the things to let that individual know that you care about them, and that you have their best interest at heart, it's not going to work really all that
mm-hmm,
well.
Mm-hmm.
I love books. If you hadn't noticed, another book called The Anatomy of Peace by the.
Mm.
Oh, I'm going to have to go and find it for you because I didn't think to pull this book out. But it's a book that describes ways that you can ask people to change. And they look at it that there's this pyramid. And the top of the pyramid is asking somebody for change. And it's like the tip of the iceberg. The last thing that most of us do is ask people to change. But there's a number of things you can do before you get there.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the core ones is to build your relationship with that person.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at failed marriages and you look at marriages that work, and you compare the two of them, what is the biggest difference? Well, in marriages that don't work, there are as many negative things said between spouses as positive, or even more negative things than positive said between a spouse. But in good marriages, there's 4 good things said to every negative comment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same thing here. If you need to build a relationship with somebody, you can actually count how many times you say something positive about that individual or some reason that you care about them or something positive. 4 negative to 16 positives.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to say, I want you to change, you're going to have had to do that for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You will have had to build that relationship with that individual for a while. And that can be hard. It's work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, relationships are work. They really work.
And especially if you've developed a pattern where there's some distrust entering in, then you've got a little bit of repair work to do, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And it's perfectly okay to say, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't handle that very well.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you should.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you should. You should say you're sorry. Everybody makes mistakes. Every single one of us does. So these techniques that I'm talking about come from a form of therapy called dialectical behavioral therapy, which was developed for people with a specific kind of personality disorder called borderline personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And people with that particular illness have a great deal of difficulty managing their emotions. And because of that, they have very chaotic interpersonal relationships.
Mm.
And so what this form of therapy does is helps them, gives them mnemonics that they can think of, mnemonics being like, what did you say about fire, drop and roll? Stop, drop, and roll, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You have these little catchwords inside your head that remind you of things to do when you're
mm-hmm.
in a state of high emotion. And so these skills do that. They give you these mnemonics that you can help remind yourself of these things as you're sitting and talking to someone in the moment. So
mm-hmm.
it's very helpful for the. Yeah, it's really, really helpful. And so this form of therapy was developed originally for people who have borderline personality disorder, but it's been shown now in depression and anxiety disorders, and it's just an extremely useful set of skills for people that have PTSD and for adolescents. I mean, she's now used in a broad number of things, and I think they're life skills that we should teach every kid in high school.
These are skills that need to be developed. They don't come easily sometimes, especially if you're kind of in a loop. And one of the questions that's coming in over and over again is how do you redirect OCBs, obsessive compulsive behaviors? How do you break patterns? How do you introduce new things?
Obsessive compulsive behaviors are really perseverative behaviors. And the reason that it's important to distinguish the two is that you need to understand that perseveration is a repetitive thought that individual cannot stop.
Mm-hmm.
They can't stop it. They can't stop it with will, and they can't stop it with insight. They can't stop it. It's a wiring problem inside their brain. They got a wire crossed.
Mm-hmm.
And because they can't stop it, what you see in people who perseverate is that they have the same thought, and if it's pleasant, wonderful, everybody wants to perseverate about good things, and that's not going to be a problem. It's when people perseverate about difficult things, or they perseverate about something they want you to do, right?
Right.
And if you frustrate their desire, they're going to get agitated. Or if just the very fact they've got this thing going through their head over and over and over again, they get agitated and they just can't ratchet themselves back. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason why it's necessary to break that pattern for them. The problem is that you may break that pattern for them right now, but it's going to be back in 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's likely not going to be, I'll bet you that if you polled your listeners and the people that are having difficulty with this, and you ask them, how many different perseverative behaviors does your loved one have? They would name 3, maybe 4 things
mm-hmm.
that individual perseverates about all the time. Maybe it's medicines. Maybe it's getting a shower on Tuesday mornings, or maybe it's about an interpersonal problem that they've had for years and it's just kind of stuck in their head and they relive mm-hmm. it and relive it and relive it. But there's probably only a handful of things that those people perseverate about. And so there's a couple ways to handle that. One is that to not expose them to triggers that develop those thought patterns.
Mm-hmm.
There, for example, if they have an interpersonal problem with somebody, where they've had an argument with somebody, you steer them away from that person. They just should not be around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be difficult if it's a loved one or a family member, it might be the memory of somebody from the past.
Mm-hmm.
You don't sit down and go through albums that have that person's picture in it. So you don't present them with the stimulus as much as possible. That's one way to do it, is to not present somebody with that stimulus. For example, my family has very heated arguments sometimes about politics. That's just one thing we don't talk about anymore. we just don't talk about politics anymore. It's not useful for some of my family members who get really distressed talking about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They get really heated, you know? And it's just not it doesn't make the day good. And that's the goal, is to have every day be good. So there are just some things you need to avoid. If you can't avoid it, or it's internally, comes out of nowhere, it's internally generated,
mm-hmm.
then there's a couple of different things that you can do. The first is redirect somebody.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to ask about that.
And the kinds of things to redirect somebody to need to be sensory. They need to be
mm-hmm.
something that you can touch, or you can taste, or you can smell, or you can see, or you can hear.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone is perseverating over and over again, you can take them to something that you know is very pleasant. So if you take them to a picture of their grandchild, or you take them and you say, look, we're cooking a pie tonight. Do you smell that? And it might be something just that subtle that'll break it in that moment.
I use our puppy dog.
Right. And that's,
definitely.
You know, a puppy dog is sensory, right? They kind
yep,
of
yep, yep, yep.
They make noise, right?
Yes, and I've been told that that's not going to work this time, but then it does.
Yeah, yeah. So those are the kinds of things.
Yep.
Now, so there's another way that you can begin to teach a behavior. So you're talking about breaking a perseverative behavior. So is there some way that you could, instead of breaking a perseverative behavior, begin a new one that's healthier?
Mm-hmm.
So developing new behaviors in people with Huntington's is possible. People with Huntington's can learn. They learn more slowly than other people do. And they fatigue faster than other people do.
Right.
So you might be able to sit down, or, you know, a kid might be able to sit down with multiplication tables and do them for 15 minutes. That would be exhausting to a Huntington's patient to
mm-hmm.
learn it, something like that. You have to be slower, and you have to be much more focused. And you have to learn during the good times, during the good hours. So if you're going to teach somebody a new behavior, you should probably pair it with a pleasant one. And I'll give you an example of it.
Pair it with a what? I'm sorry.
A positive experience.
Okay.
So I'll give you an example, and this is an example from my family. So my dad, when he had advanced Huntington's and did have a fair number of perseverative behaviors, and those perseverative behaviors interfered with my mother's ability to take care of his hygiene.
Mm-hmm.
So hygiene became this battle, right? And it was because he had all the other things going on inside his mind. So what my mother did was she started singing to him when she gave him a bath.
Oh.
And she sang him songs from their youth that
mm-hmm.
they danced to, or that they sang with us when we were little kids. And all of that made him happy. And he was more likely to focus on the happy stuff than he would. It was a strong enough stimulus, and his emotion toward it was strong enough that it stopped all the other stuff. She got him through baths, every you know, and bathing.
That's
awesome. And then after a while, as she did that more and more and more, then bathing became something he began to look forward to, because it was
mm-hmm.
a close time for them.
Mm-hmm.
It was an intimate time for them. But it wouldn't have happened if she hadn't figured out how to make it happy.
Mm-hmm.
And something that he enjoyed. She made it something he could enjoy.
Good job.
It was amazing to watch, actually. But I think one of the things that made that so successful for her was that she always believed that his behaviors came from somewhere, that they had some basis in reality.
Mm-hmm.
And she knew much less about, there were no terms, there were no, you know, there were no education classes. She just figured this stuff out.
Wow.
She did have a friend of hers, and the two of them would periodically talk about a behavior, and they would brainstorm together. But she never fought them. She didn't mm-hmm. She didn't fight the reality of those symptoms. She just said, okay, now I'm going to have to get my creative juices going here so that I can figure out what I can do to help him through this.
What a great woman.
Oh, no kidding. So the other thing that this kind of brings up to me, and I don't have any evidence about this at all, this is purely anecdotal from my experience, there are some people who caregiving and doing these things for come more naturally than other people. So in 2010, the HDSA convention was here in Raleigh, and I gave a talk, and I talked about these skills that people can use. And, you know, I was all excited and pumped up about it, and, you know, I was really excited to share it with everybody. And after the talk was over, this man walked up to me, and he looked at me, and he said, "So what if you don't want to do all this stuff? What if you don't want to do all this stuff?" And it dawned on me that he needed to find somebody who could. If he couldn't do it, he needed to find somebody who could. And that was my, I didn't have that answer when he talked to me. But as I thought about what he said, it was, what is it if you can't do these things?
Right.
What if you're too tired to do these things? What if it if you're depressed yourself and your creativity is out the window? What if you don't have the financial resources to get some extra help? What if you can't do it? And so, as I was talking about with journaling, I think that if you journal things, it becomes clear that it's maybe you're more distressed than the other person is, mm-hmm. because you can't do everything you think you should do or even everything that's needed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a hard place to be. It's a really hard place. It's a point of acceptance. It's difficult to accept that things aren't the way you want them to be, and you can't make them that way.
Right.
So, Marsha Linehan, who developed dialectical behavioral therapy, she said a couple things. She said, well, there's a limited number of options when you have a difficult reality. You can change it. You can change how you feel about it, right? It's bad, but it's not as bad as it could be. There's some good things about this. I mean, you can coach yourself to see it differently and therefore feel differently about it.
Right.
You can accept that you can't accept it. You can accept the fact that it's a completely unacceptable situation and let it go.
That's a hard place to be.
And
okay, I have a very, very, very important question for you from one of our
very hard place to be.
Sure. Listeners in the chat room. Jim, he says, do you think that someone with denial, lack of insight, is a coping mechanism?
I think denial is, by definition, a coping mechanism. Self-deception is a different story. And so it's important to know the difference. Right? And it's kind of hard to figure it out if somebody won't sit down and talk to you. So maybe when you talk to somebody, instead of talking about the problem, you talk about how they are. How are you doing? How are you doing today? Not, oh, don't give me that. I want to hear how you're really doing with this.
Mm-hmm.
You look like you're having a bad day. Or it looked like you had a great day Tuesday and you're not having such a great day today. Is there something I can do? Is, you know, what's going on with you? And most people truly do respond to that. Everybody wants to be paid attention to.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that answers the question or not, but I think if you don't know whether it's self-deception or denial or anagnosia, you're in a fact-gathering phase.
True. Then you need to go back to defining the problem, right?
You got to go back to defining the problem.
And maybe the journaling technique is a good way to do that. I do journal, but not all the time. And when I do find that I journal, guess what? Things kind of appear to be more apparent.
Yes.
And a solution can be found a little bit more easily. You're not operating from the stance of being in crisis all the time.
Right. You know, there are people who are introverts and extroverts, so introverts work things out within themselves. Journaling would be great for them. People who are extroverts work their problems out outside of them, and those people kind of need somebody to listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to know which kind of person you are. So that you can direct yourself to the best circumstance in which you can get all that stuff out of you.
Yeah.
I think extroverts can journal too. I'm not saying that they can't. I think that extroverts would be happier sitting down and having somebody listen to them. You know.
Yeah,
so.
Sure. Interesting stuff. Well, listen,
yeah.
Are we ready for a break right now? We'll come back and do some questions and go over the rest of your outline.
Sure.
Okay, let's take a quick break. James, you with us there? Can you give us a little break here? And we'll be right back with everyone.
All
be
right.
Sure to write down your questions, and when we come back, we'll try to get your questions answered. Be right back, everyone. Hello, everybody out there. Got the questions ready for us, hopefully. We actually had a question come in in the screening room today. So, Dr. Edmondson, can you kind of summarize that and give us a little solution to what that
Sure.
is about?
So this is the situation. There's an individual who is at a stage of illness that they need someone with them all the time, and they have a very rigid schedule. They do, they watch shows, and they do things at a very specific time. They have to eat at the same time, take medicine at the same time, and if there's any deviation from that routine, all hell breaks loose. I don't know how else to say it, but it feels kind of like that. And so if there are things that this individual has to do, like go to the doctor or whatever, you can guarantee that it's going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult on somebody, and definitely probably will be difficult on him. So the question is, how do you manage that? So my first question is, and remember, you're going and journaling this, why does he need to leave the house? Does he need to leave the house, or do you want him to leave the house? And if you want him to leave the house and it's causing him more distress, then you're not doing him any favors. Okay, I know that everybody wants to create a socially enriched environment for people with Huntington's because use it or lose it, right? The longer you stay on your feet, the longer you'll stay on your feet. The more you keep going out, the more you'll be capable of going out. But there does come a point for people with Huntington's where the world gets too complicated. Mm. It's just too tough to be out there. There's too many stimuli out there. And the reason that people get rigid is not because they're trying to drive anybody crazy, and that's not perseveration. That is a way that that individual remembers what to do next. It's their way of that schedule tells them how they need to shift to do something different now. It's their shortcut. It's their shorthand to get them through the day. And it's the way that they have internally made their world safe. If things happen this way all the time, then there's no I don't have to worry. I'm not going to have to come up with an answer for this problem off the cuff. And so understanding how a person's brain works with Huntington's, they have difficulty task sequencing, they have trouble organizing, and they have trouble with initiative. And they have difficulty tuning out irrelevant stimuli, irrelevant information. And so as time goes by, their filter gets more and more porous, and they have less and less capability of filtering out noise, sound, smells, a change in their environment. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a point when it's going to be too difficult for them to get out. Mm. And so the question is always, are they there now? And the only way that you can answer that question is to see how hard it is on them to do it. And so there's no magic answer to that. The answer is it on balance a better experience for him than it is a negative experience? And so as you're journaling, you look at it from his point of view, and you look at it from the point of view of your family. And in this particular individual has a large family. And they have a very socially connected, active family. And they've done all of these things year after year. They're sort of family traditions and things that are part of their traditions. And to not include him in those traditions is sort of unthinkable, right? We love him. We want him to be with us. And so if he can't be, because it's too hard on him to do those things anymore, there's grief because your family has changed. And there is a hole in your family now. And it may be that there's two holes because not only does he stay back, someone else from the family has to stay back because he can't be by himself. Mm-hmm. So there's two holes. And so going is not nearly as much fun for everybody else. But I think that if you can say that, if you can be open about that with yourself, and you can be open about it with the other people in your family, that these are the things that our family's changing. These are the things that how we're going to have to adapt to this. This is what we can do to adapt. We can say it's okay for us to go to the hockey game tonight. Mary's going to have to stay back and take care of Dad. And today Mary stays back and takes care of Dad. And next week everybody's going to go to the hockey game and Mary's going to go and somebody else is going to stay back. And our family, we have to be more flexible than other families do because we have somebody we love that we, you know, take care of. And maybe this week is a week he can go to the hockey game, right, because it's a better week. And last week was a really bad week, and it's not the week to go. It's kind of like, you know, when you have toddlers and when you have young children, you just really can never count on anything because you never know what kind of day it's going to be
right.
for them. And
they may need a nap.
They may need a nap. They mm-hmm. may, you know, they may not be able to tolerate going to the grocery store and, you know, by God, you need to go. And sometimes you're going to have to do that. But if you don't have to do that, don't, because it will be easier for you. It'll be easy. In some situations, it's easier for you to have that hole in your day, that hole in your experience as a family or as a couple or whatever. It's going to be easier for you to do it alone, and easier on the person at home. So bottom line, I can't answer that question for anybody. I think that's a question for the people who know that person the best, and they know the context the best, i.e., he's got this schedule that he keeps every day, and if he does these things, he feels safe and he's doing okay. If we take him out of that situation, he gets distressed, but does he get more happy than he gets distressed? And on balance, it's a good thing. Even if he has an extra day that he's got to recover, that's okay. We'll take him, right?
Yeah.
And if the pleasure that he gets from doing that activity is minimal in comparison to the degree of distress that he has, then it's like a no-brainer.
Yeah.
He's going to have to not go.
Awesome.
I'm talking about hard stuff.
You really are, and I just want to tell you that this is something that I think all of us have experienced to one degree or another. I've experienced that myself with my situation here. But the person that asked this question says, "You rock." And thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome.
And
it's hard
yeah,
stuff. It really is hard.
It is. Okay, now, you know, we have a whole nother segment of this program, and we're already looking at an hour on the show. Do you want to reschedule and do part two on another day, or do we want to
sure.
keep going?
Sure.
Okay, because this is going to get long for everyone.
Yeah. Well, I think that's probably a good idea, especially because we haven't covered one topic under anagnosia that I think is a pretty important one.
Well, do you want to finish that one out, and then we'll do a second segment or a second show for the complications of HD?
Mm-hmm. That'd be fine.
Okay. Let's do that.
Okay. We've got till how long, Melissa?
As long as you can go.
Okay. So the last thing on my bullet points is the whole question of decision-making ability. And so this is something that I work with people all the time in making judgments about their ability to make informed decisions. It's not an issue of whether they make good decisions or bad decisions. It's whether or not they can make informed decisions. So, for example, sometimes I'm asked to come see a patient in the hospital and give an opinion about that individual's decision-making capability. And so I have this script I go through, these questions that I ask. And the first question is, why are you here and what is your problem? Can they describe to me exactly what their problem is? Can they describe to me what the options for managing that problem are? Can they articulate to me a choice? Can they tell me what they want? And if all of those things are there, that person has decision-making ability.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody can't articulate what their problem is, they can't articulate their options, then they don't have decision-making capability. And when somebody doesn't have decision-making capability, then the question becomes, is the problem facing them something serious enough that someone else has to intervene?
Mm-hmm.
So, let's say in that case that we were just talking about, that this gentleman who has a very rigid schedule, right, and you let him have his rigid schedule because it makes him feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
But one day, he starts having a medical problem that has the potential for being dire, okay, mm-hmm. has the potential for being bad. Then you have to, and they're not aware that they have to do it, you have to break their routine. They're resisting you. At what point do you force them to do it?
Mm-hmm.
That's really hard, right? That's a hard
yeah.
question to ask yourself.
Yeah.
So I'll give you an example from my family life. My dad developed an ulcer and threw up blood for 3 days before
mm-hmm.
we got him to the hospital.
Mm-mm-mm.
And in retrospect, we should have called 911 the very first day, right?
Oh.
But we were not wise enough at that point, nor did we have enough skills to say, we're in one of those moments where we simply have to take over for you. We have to, I don't care that this is bothering you. I don't care that it's a problem, and I don't care that you're suffering. We have to do this now. I mean, the house is burning down. We have to get out, you know? And,
wow.
So the issue is with someone when you're wondering when to act on their behalf is how serious is it? And if it's not serious, can that individual describe to me what it is they want? Can they express their desires to me in some way so that I know what they would want for me to do about this? I can think of one situation where this becomes an issue with Huntington's, and that is if you have somebody who is losing weight, badly losing weight,
mm-hmm.
and they are resisting the interventions that are needed to do that, or they don't understand that the problem is that they're actually not eating enough, or they're not eating even though you prepare meals for them and you leave it for them, and so they've got breakfast, lunch, and dinner, but they don't eat it because they forget about it, or they're perseverating and they can't remember to eat.
Mm-hmm.
They won't take their medicine. They're not capable of taking their medicine independently anymore. You know, and the thing about it with Huntington's is, like, everything comes to a head at once, right?
Yeah.
You can say, oh, somebody's losing weight or whatever, but it's like there's a number of factors that are all going not well at any one time. Not any one of them would be enough for you to intervene, but the constellation of those problems
mm-hmm.
means that you have to intervene.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times that tends to come up around nutrition and
uh-huh.
Tends to come up around medication compliance, taking the right medicine. And again, it goes back to you journal and you figure out where the suffering is, and if you take over for someone else, is their suffering going to decrease?
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And legitimately, whether yours will decrease as well. Because the person who takes care of somebody with Huntington's, their welfare and how they're doing is the most important factor in how that person with Huntington's is doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's it, really.
Bottom line.
You cannot take a caregiver out of the equation.
No.
You just can't. You just can't do it. So if you're going to, I'm just going to talk real briefly about a couple of things. So let's say that there's a major situation that requires an intervention, and it's primarily psychiatric. It's primarily a psychiatric issue. Somebody is irritable to the point of aggression. Aggression is never acceptable, ever, ever, ever. It is not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And aggression can be towards property. It can be towards other people. And on to a lesser level, the threat of violence is as bad as violence. So that can't be a chronic thing. Aggression is just not acceptable, and something has to happen.
Right.
And if that person can't deal with that, or they can't, I mean, it doesn't matter whether it's self-deception or denial or anagnosia.
Mm-hmm.
It's not acceptable. And if something doesn't happen through insight, you're going to have to act on their behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that you figure out how the laws in your state work. In North Carolina, you go to the magistrate and you, you know, do an affidavit. And they
mm-hmm.
send the cops out and they pick them up, take them to a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to be evaluated by a psychiatrist. If it's a medical problem, you call 911,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
If it's not something that's imminently a problem, like aggression, let's say it's, you know, sort of progressive weight loss, and that it's not an issue of imminence, then you have two options. You can develop a team approach to the problem, where you get all the people who are key to the solution or key to the problem. You bring all the people who are stakeholders in this issue, and you put them all in a room, and you say, what is it that needs to happen? And if there's consensus that somebody needs to go to an assisted living facility, or somebody needs to go to a psychiatric hospital, or they need to go to the doctor, they need to take medicine, they need to do something, and there's some level of consensus amongst those stakeholders, then if there's consensus, then you bring the person with Huntington's into that experience of being with those other people, and it's just like an intervention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You all say, this is what has to happen. I love you. This is what's going to happen if we don't do this. I know how bad you don't want to do this. I know how bad this is for you, but this is what has to happen, and this is what's going to happen, and it's going to happen today. And so that means that you have to have everything set up ahead of time.
Right.
You have to move very swiftly, and it needs to happen that day. And the hard part's getting there. The day it happens is not nearly as hard as all the days that lead up to it.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're making a decision for that person, what they have to do. And, you know, it's one of the most difficult things in the world to take away somebody's self-determination. It's really difficult. But honestly, you do it because in the long run, it's going to be better for that person.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put yourself in their shoes and say, if I was in their position, what would I want them to do?
Mm-hmm.
If I was that person, what would I want my family to do? And you do, you know, you're just not cavalier. You think it through. You make your best judgment. You make your best guess. And you do it. And things might turn out good. They might not turn out good. But you know you did your best.
Right. And it may or may not be a permanent situation. Maybe it's a temporary situation.
Correct. And
you know?
maybe the part that's temporary is that, and the example I can give you is having to put somebody in a facility of some type. Maybe you put them in a facility and you get the acute problem dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that person's in a better place, they're physically better, they're emotionally better, then you say, okay, well, it looks like you're going to have to be in this kind of a place because none of us can take care of you, but let's go find the one you like. Let's go take some outings and go find the place you want. Now you have a choice. Let's go figure out what your choices are, and then you can make a decision for yourself where you want to go. The fact you have to go someplace is not a choice, but where you go is.
Mm-hmm.
Those are difficult moments, but if you can just keep yourself focused on what is the problem and what is the goal, it gets a whole lot easier.
Number one,
journal, figure out what's the problem.
And where is the suffering coming from?
That's exactly
good
right.
Good stuff. Oh, my goodness. Let's see. We do have a few questions. Do you have time to answer just a couple questions here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, it's good stuff. Okay, here's one. In late stage when breathing is difficult, why does it take a while for them to calm down after eating? Do we know the...
I can't tell you for sure, but I do know that eating is a pretty anxiety-provoking experience for people who have involuntary inspirations, and they're chewing something and swallowing, and then they suck it down into their airway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that doesn't happen to you. That doesn't have to happen to you more than once for you to be scared of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that a lot of people, their chorea actually gets worse when they eat because they're scared of it.
Wow.
So it very well might be that you could experiment with some relaxation exercises beforehand, before you eat.
Mm-hmm.
You can add something pleasant into it, along the lines of, you know, singing songs from your youth. Find things that you can do to make it a social, interactive, fun experience in some way, so that you can kind of distract them from the anxiety. And then sometimes you have to sit with somebody who's going through that experience. I think I went to Minnesota, and they have a nursing unit where that's entirely devoted to taking care of Huntington's patients. And the woman who runs that program is one of the most phenomenal HD caregivers I have ever seen. And the day that I went there, there was a 21-year-old woman who had really bad chorea, and she was sort of new to the unit. This woman was kind of showing me around and introducing me to the different people, introducing me to the staff. And this young woman started to have these flinging experiences of her body.
Mm-hmm.
And she was getting more and more upset. And I swear to God, this woman just ditched me and went and got right into that experience with that woman. She was right there experiencing it with her. I don't know if you know what I mean. She was with her. She was like, I hear what you're going through. I'm right here with you.
Yeah.
I'm not going to let you go.
Ease the fear of it, right?
It just having somebody there with you can make a huge difference.
Yeah.
You know, when you're so scared and things are happening to you that you just don't have any control over. And, I mean, I think it'd be pretty scary to choke. And I think it would take me a while to calm down.
I think so, too. And like you said, you know, by putting yourself in that person's place and thinking, what would it be like if I were in that person's shoes, right?
Mm-hmm. Do you have any other questions?
Yeah, I do. Okay, why isn't depression and anxiety being looked at more than the movement disorder?
That's
a loaded one, right?
Yeah, it really is. I think for many years, before we had predictive testing, before we had something that could prove somebody had Huntington's, it's been, 20 years since the gene was discovered, and we've had an entire generation now grow through that.
Mm-hmm.
So we have 10 years of data, predict data, for example, that shows that psychiatric symptoms begin anywhere from 7 to 15 years before motor diagnosis. And you can imagine what it would be like to be a physician with somebody that you knew was at risk, who was depressed and was, you know, having some of the problems that this case I was telling you about taking somebody out, and do I take them out, do I not take them out? I mean, it's a stressful life. And you're like, okay, now I'm not going to falsely ascribe to this person Huntington's disease when they have a pretty good reason to be unhappy and to be depressed.
Right.
Because their, you know, brother's sick, their father died, whatever it might be. You know, and so I think that for a long time, physicians didn't want to falsely diagnose Huntington's before they had proof. And I think that's the reason. I don't think that's going to be the reason going forward now that we have this data.
Mm-hmm.
Now we know, for one thing, we're going to have much better cognitive tests. We're going to have much better tests, some combinations of different measures that are going to help us do a better job of determining when people's symptoms are actually related to Huntington's.
Right. And do you think caregivers will be more involved in that process?
I think that the data is all there. I think it's a matter of evaluating that data. I think it's really complicated because it's a huge data set.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that work is being done.
Okay.
I just don't think it's matured yet.
Okay, we have a question in the chat room. Can we get the name of that nursing home in Minnesota, please?
I keep thinking that I ought to figure out what's so unique about her. And what is so unique about some people? I mean, some people are just so incredible.
I would love to
interview
her.
They just are so incredible. She's great. I can't remember the name. It's a hospital or a nursing facility that has an entire wing for Huntington's patients.
Oh,
it's in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and she's the director of the unit. She's great.
Wow,
I was so impressed with her.
So, if you remember, will you tell me, and I can get back with the person in the chat room?
Yeah, I'm sure I can. I will find that, and I'll give it to you.
Okay. Okay, so person in the chat room, I will get back to you as she finds that information. She said she's going to look it up. Okay, I will look it up now. She mentioned the city. So, but if you happen to remember, be sure and let me know, and I'll relay the information to her.
I think our social worker has her name,
but
I'm going to have to. I'll have to look that up.
Now, is she an RN or is she a psychiatric
nurse? Her name is Gail something.
okay.
I'm sure that the Minneapolis St. Paul HDSA group would have that information.
Okay. All right, super. Let's see.
Oh, it's Good Samaritan Center, University Good Samaritan Center.
Good.
Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Very good. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, thank you. Person in chat room says thank you. Okay, here's a question for you, if you can still hang with us. Sleeping issues with HD. Why are they having so many problems with sleeping?
It's because... So there's this little timer inside your head that regulates your biorhythms, one of which is sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And when that alarm goes off, you know, you're going to go to sleep. And when that alarm stops going off, you're going to wake up. And so it's called your circadian rhythm.
Right.
And that seems to be impaired in Huntington's disease.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not uncommon at all for people to develop relatively significantly impairing sleep disorders.
Mm-hmm.
And if that is an issue, there are medications that are pretty useful for that. Again, no one studied, there's no FDA-approved treatment for anything, any behavioral symptoms of Huntington's, but there is a way to adapt information from other disorders. mm-hmm. and apply them to Huntington's. So, you know, there's a number of different sleep aids that are available to people that have sleep disorders because of other psychiatric symptoms, trazodone, Seroquel, Ambien. I mean, there's a number of them that are available. And so one of the things that you can do is you can take advantage of a sedating effect of a drug mm-hmm. that's used for something else. For example, if you have somebody, if somebody's being treated for irritability and they're being treated with an antipsychotic, for example, mm-hmm. you might choose the antipsychotic in that class that has the most sedating properties.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you get two for one.
Yep. Good idea. Okay, I think they, I think we're ready to wrap it up. I think this has just been fantastic information. I know that it's going to go out to thousands of people, and I look forward to scheduling another show with you to go over the complications of HD with a look toward prevention. I have a lot more questions from the community that we can actually complement this next section of information from you, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
And spending this time with us. It's a wonderful thing for you to do for us. And James, did you have any other questions real quick in the chat room or anything?
No, but thank you so much, Dr.
Yes.
It's been wonderful.
You're welcome.
Wonderful.
Now,
it's my pleasure.
Okay, so if you all in the chat room or people listening in the archives, Dr. Mary C. Edmondson is Clinical Associate in Psychiatry at Duke University Medical Center, and the website is nc-cchd.org.
That's correct.
And if you want to call her, no, we don't want to give that number, do we?
It's I'm not very reliable in that regard.
Okay.
What would
give the email?
Best, you can send questions to us at hdinfo@nc-cchd.org.
Okay, very good. And she is in Raleigh, North Carolina. So I just want to thank Dr. Mary Edmondson for coming on the show and spending all this time with us. We so appreciate it. This concludes.
You're welcome. Can
HD
I make
view.
One shameless plug before we close?
Sure.
So November 7th through 9th this year, we in North Carolina are hosting the Huntington Study Group annual meeting.
Wonderful.
So it's going to be held in Charlotte, and the Saturday of that meeting is going to be open to the public.
Wonderful.
And anyone is very welcome to come and keep your eyes open because some great stuff's going to come. Okay?
Awesome. Do you have an agenda or conference schedule yet?
Not yet, but
okay.
We've got invitations out, and as soon as we hear back from our guests, we will have it up.
Okay, well, be sure
it up and running.
Send me an email, and I'll send it out to the community as well.
Okay.
And I just
want
to thank you again. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in tonight. Don't forget to contact me at helpforhd-international.org. Find us on Facebook, Help for HD, the HD View. Come back and listen to the recorded episodes. Get the free app, On the Road, Help for HD, at helpforhd-international.org. And also available on the app is the original mobile connection to education resources and information about JHD and HD. Good night, everyone. Talk to you next Monday. Thank you. Have a great week.
Good night.
Good night, y'all.